Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, over the many years that American Variety has been on the air, we've had two or three shows on the topic of UFOs. And usually I begin by saying something along the lines of, well, there are really only two big questions for humanity. Is there life after death? And are we alone in the universe? And everything else is just details. And so I guess I'm starting this show off the same way. So this week we're going to delve into the ever elusive second question once again. And I say elusive because there never seems to be concrete evidence of the existence of UFOs. And partly as a result of that, it's usually treated with humor or even derision by the media and by government and by science. And qualified observers are therefore often reluctant to report sightings. But recently those attitudes have begun to shift. In 2004 and again in 2015, some Navy pilots filmed with their gun cameras odd-looking objects out over the Pacific off San Diego, and they leaked that footage a couple years later to the media. Other pilots then followed suit with similar videos. Then in 2020, the Defense Department declassified the videos and finally admitted that they were real and that the objects in them were unexplained, and the traditional dam began to break, both in government and in academe. There's now a willingness to look into this fascinating topic with the seriousness that I think it deserves. My guest is Richard Klute, a Harvard research fellow with a PhD in computer science who's on the research team of something called the Galileo Project. And we'll describe in a minute what that is. Welcome, Richard.
Hi, Court. Thank you very much for having me on today. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being on. It's going to be interesting, I think. So maybe as part of that shift in official attitudes that I mentioned, the Defense Department has renamed UFOs as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, or UAP, which I guess is probably a way to put some distance between the new official interest and the old stigma of interest in UFOs by all kinds of people. I mentioned the Galileo Project, of which you were a part, Richard. So why don't you start by telling us about it?
Yeah, sure. So the Galileo Project is a scientific project that was founded in July 2021, just after the report that was made public from the DoD. And essentially what we're doing is we're just trying to set up instrumentation to collect data of the surrounding environment and look for anomalies. And in the case we observe a UAP, we'll have data to back that up. So it's really just a data collection exercise and an attempt to look for anomalies, scientific anomalies.
So I think the founder of the Galileo Project is a Harvard professor, an eminent astronomer, and I guess an astrophysicist or a physicist to start with named Avi Loeb. I guess he's your boss, but why don't you give me a little background on him and how he kind of broke the ice on this topic academically to some extent from his eminent position at Harvard, which was something people had been afraid to do before. And he went where no man had dared go and did some of that. So why don't you give us a little background just briefly on that?
Yeah. So Avi is my boss. He's the head of the Galileo Project. He founded it together with Frank Lorkin, who's a chemist as well. Avi's got a broad background in astrophysics, so he launched the Galileo Project, and he's brought on a lot of engineers and scientists, brought us all together to try and understand what are we actually observing in the sky, try and understand this mystery. And he's been the chair of the Harvard Astronomy Department for more than 10 years. He served there as the head, so he's a very prominent scientist, and He's obviously got a lot of weight around to him when he comes into this field and says, look, there's something interesting. We should take note and we're going to investigate.
Yeah, so he's a person through his academic stature who's difficult to just ignore. And that was part of the key to getting, as I mentioned, the ice broken on some of this. And yeah, so the Galileo Project, obviously it's named after Galileo, a scientist back in, I forget which century, 14th or 15th, who had proven to himself that the Earth rotated around the sun and or revolved around the sun. And he was treated as a heretic for that and barely escaped, burning at the stake or something. But he was right. And the prevailing scientific establishment at the time, such as it was wrong. So eventually we know his name today and we don't know theirs. So the main goal of the Galileo Project, I think, is to, you know, you kind of alluded to it, make it more scientific and really to bring the search for extraterrestrial technological signatures from being accidental or anecdotal kind of observations of the reports that, you know, you get from you know, people on their back deck or a policeman at midnight or whatever, and kind of mythology like that to the mainstream of transparent and validated and systematic scientific research. And so that's the kind of thing you're involved in. So, you know, I think there are two specific project goals under that. Can you kind of recap what those are for us?
Yeah, sure. So, well, the main goal of the Galileo project is essentially deploying instrumentation to try and understand what UAP are, right? It's a fishing expedition, as Avi often likes to say. We're about data. Data is critical to science. And so what we want to do is basically just capture as much information as we can about our environment and look to see if there's any sort of outliers there, any sort of anomalies. And so we want to characterize things like the birds, aircraft, balloons, anything that you might find in the sky. And then we want to look at the data and see if any of these observations that we've been making are kind of performing in ways that are uncharacteristic of what we know to be natural or man-made. And so we can say, okay, that looks like an anomaly, and we'll go through some extra steps and to analyze that and say, okay, this is something truly a true scientific anomaly. Because you might have anomalies which are not necessarily true scientific anomalies. You know, it might just be some trick of the light or unknown to us, but not known, but known to somebody else, so on and so forth. So that's the first part of the project. And the second part of the project is looking at interstellar objects. So things like Oumuamua or Borisov. Those are the only two known interstellar objects that are more confirmed interstellar objects. And this part of the project is really looking not within the Earth's atmosphere, like the UAP segment of the project is. This is looking out into space using data from, for instance, the LSST, or the Vera Rubin telescope, as it's also known as, to try and detect interstellar objects and characterize them and understand more about their origin and their composition and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so interstellar objects might be things that come into our solar system from outside our solar system and that, you know, like asteroids and comets, but they exhibit characteristics that are different from what those objects normally show. And so I think that's, you know, kind of to put it another way, that's the second part of that goal is to figure out their origins and their characteristics and what makes them do what they do, right? So you're doing this research in concert with the Pentagon's newly established All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. The acronym is AARO. Let me repeat that since it's a mouthful. All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. And so that in itself is a first to have an office like that in the Pentagon. And the fact that they're doing it in collaboration with the university, with Harvard in this case, is probably a first. So what does that office do, and what's the interaction between Harvard and them been like on your end?
Okay, well, the office is, as my understanding goes, is mainly just to set the groundwork for investigating UAP, right? They know that there's something going on. They know that there's something in the sky that's doing things that you know, are different to what our known systems are capable of. They're exhibiting much more advanced flight characteristics. But we don't yet have any data as to what those objects actually represent. And so I think this department, ARRO, are setting the initial investigation up into looking at UAP from a government kind of standpoint. And so they've got some funding, and I think they're also looking to set up some instrumentation as well and collect their own data. But they're also looking back through the records, right? So back to, what, 1946 or something like that, and trying to get a better understanding about the history of the phenomenon and see if there's anything they can learn from that.
So, you know, again, in terms of collaboration, how tightly are they working with you, if at all?
Well, yeah, so we're not really working with ARRO. Avi did obviously publish a paper with Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, and that's about as far as our interaction has gone. Of course, we are in connection, so we do have contacts there, but we're not actively collaborating with them at this point. We're just, you know, we've got some link there, but it's very minimal at this stage.
So you mentioned that they're looking back historically, back into the 40s, and I know that back in the 60s, there was a Project Blue Book, which the Air Force put in place ostensibly to collect UFO reports and study them. But I think it was largely a PR operation aimed at placating a curious public with mundane explanations like it's Venus and it's weather balloons and it's flights of birds and whatever. And it actually buried those sightings that were clearly unexplainable. And they did find and categorize some that they had no explanation for inside that office, but they didn't really make that public. They didn't talk about it. So to the extent you can tell, is the AARO, the new office, fundamentally different from that old Project Blue Book effort?
Well, we've seen a lot of progress in this topic in the last five or so years, as you mentioned in your intro. And so I think we should just give them the benefit of the doubt for the time being. It's too early, I would say, to really know what their purpose is or what will come out of that study. But from my perspective, what I've seen so far, it looks like a legitimate approach and they look sincere. So I would give them the benefit of the doubt and just keep following what they're doing, and we'll see in a few years.
Yeah, I think the explanation used to be when kind of forced to the wall and in terms of, you know, especially by high-level politicians, why aren't you telling the public what you know about this stuff? It was like, well, one explanation anyway that was often given was the public isn't ready to handle that information. It might cause, mm-hmm. you know, widespread panic and that sort of thing. But I think, you know, between TV shows and just general exposure to that idea and also the thousands of people who've come forward, you know, with video cameras and so on. Now, you know, there's more information out there that's, you know, kind of mm-hmm. looks hard to explain away in a simplistic fashion. And so I think people are not prone to panic about that idea. They're interested in it, really. So I think it's probably the DOD has finally realized that justification for clamming up won't work anymore. So hopefully it's more open now and real.
I say, I agree. I think it's actually, you know, we had in 1947 with Roswell, for instance, the military straightforward came out and said, look, we've got a flying saucer. And then they quickly covered that up and said, no, it was just a weather balloon. And there's been a few projects going on since then. And I think what we're seeing is basically a conditioning process. I think the initial shock, if they had just come out straightforward right there and then say, guys, there's something going on here. This is potentially extraterrestrial or it's interdimensional or whatever. You know, there's lots of different theories. I think that could potentially have shocked a lot of people and really and caused a lot of disruption to society. So I think what they've engaged in is a conditioning exercise, a process to get us all desensitized to the idea that we might not actually be alone and that there might be more to reality than what we can actually perceive with our senses. So I think that's what this is basically is. And we're getting to a point, in my opinion, where the public has been conditioned enough that we're going to slowly start seeing more and more information come out of the DOD, projects like the Galileo project, and opening up into potentially a field where we haven't really explored much in the last 70 odd years, and which could potentially revolutionize our understanding of physics and our place in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, as I kind of said in the beginning, it's one of the fundamental questions. It ought to be something that science is deeply and extremely interested in, but they shy away from it as if it's a taboo for, you know, for the reasons that we mentioned. And so that mm-hmm. that's breaking up and that's good, I think. But, mm-hmm. you know, NASA started the search for extraterrestrial intelligence called SETI, which I think is now privately funded, but they started it many years ago. And it's a big radio telescope in Puerto Rico. I think it was ruined by a hurricane a few years back, but they're looking for radio signals from anywhere in the universe. And, you know, so that's a sensory thing, and it's a scientific approach to trying to detect evidence of something we could call a civilization from far, far away, mm-hmm. right? So what's the difference between Galileo and SETI, just briefly?
Yeah, so, well, the SETI program is obviously looking at radio signals. They're looking for extraterrestrial signals potentially from extraterrestrial civilizations. They're looking out into space, right? Well, the Galileo project is different because we're looking at things more locally, in our backyard, so to speak. Within the Earth's atmosphere, and we're looking at interstellar objects as well, which is not something that SETI's really interested in.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Richard Klute, who is a research fellow at Harvard and a member of the something called the Galileo Project at Harvard, which is an effort to take a serious look using a variety of high-tech sensors at all kinds of phenomena out there and trying to identify those that are different enough that they might possibly be of extraterrestrial origin. But without a bent in that direction to start with, they're just, you know, taking a scientific approach to it and looking very objectively at what they find and filtering out the obvious things and seeing what's left in the bottom of the pan that's hard to explain. So the key, Richard, seems to be that UAPs, again, that's unidentified aerial phenomena, the new name for UFOs, exhibit flight characteristics that defy the laws of physics. So can you elaborate on that some, the kind of maneuvers they make and so on?
Well, I wouldn't say that they seem to defy the laws of physics. We don't really know yet because we don't have data. We have observations from eyewitnesses and stuff, but, you know, the human eyes are not perfect and we might misinterpret what we're seeing. So only when we've actually got data that we can analyze, we can start looking to see if they are performing things that are not known to our current understanding of physics. But yes, they do apparently perform some very unusual maneuvers, such as instantly stopping or instantly accelerating, moving through different mediums without causing any disturbance. So for instance, going from space into the atmosphere and into the sea, moving at incredible speeds as well, speeds that would obviously turn any living organism in there, a human, into mush. As soon as we actually collect some sort of data, we can start narrowing down what those characteristics really are and whether they do indeed seem to be performing some feats that are beyond our current understanding of physics.
Yeah, but I think that they, when they're moving very fast, as they sometimes do, and sometimes starting from a dead stop, they'll suddenly accelerate to extreme speeds beyond anything that we can do. And yet they don't seem to heat up. They don't have the kind of ionic bulge in front of them where they're disturbing the air in an extreme way. And they're not giving off signals that would be associated with those kinds of normal physical reactions to the maneuvers they're making. So, you know, there's no radio signatures that they pick up. So that's what I meant by defying the laws of physics. They're not behaving in ways that would normally be expected of physical objects doing what they're doing. So are there any alternative explanations yet that you know of for why these objects don't emit the expected radio signatures?
Well, the thing is that we don't have in our hands yet actual data to say definitively that they are not reflecting radio signals or moving at speeds that are so fast that that they should produce a fireball, but they aren't. So once we've got the data that we can actually analyze and understand, then we can say whether they are actually performing some sort of unusual feats. But if I were to speculate, I would say, well, maybe they're using some sort of high energy field to prevent a fireball from forming as they move at like hypersonic speeds through the atmosphere.
Okay, well, I appreciate you being circumspect at this moment about it because Galileo Project is new, hasn't started much, and hasn't gotten very far down the path of doing what it intends to do, and so you can't really say much. And that's the whole point. You don't want to speculate and come out with colorful, emotional sounding headline bites that can't be backed up by what you can prove. So I understand that, and that's a good approach to take. Yep. So, but how is the Galileo Project being viewed so far by academic astronomers and astrophysicists and other scientists in general? Is that traditional skepticism being applied, or are they kind of open-minded, or how, by and large, obviously, we're talking about a wide spectrum of views, right? But by and large, how does it strike you?
Well, I've not encountered any sort of pushback from the scientific community. In fact, all I've seen is curiosity and support. And this is a good sign. Obviously, it means that, the stigma is kind of fading away, that people are starting to look at this with more respect and being more open to the possibility that there might be something out there that we don't fully understand yet. But it also is indicative that scientists are, it's indicative of scientific characteristics. So if you're a scientist, you should by nature, you should be curious, and you should be want to explore new things and understand them. And if you were a scientist and you said to me, no, this is nonsense, ignore it, it doesn't make any sense, and just kind of shied away from the whole thing, well, I'd say you're probably not a very good scientist. You're not open to the possibility that there's something going on that you don't fully understand. And if you're not curious about that, well, it speaks to your scientific curiosity and integrity.
I absolutely agree, but I think that shying away has been pretty universal until now, because it is sort of a taboo, and it's the kind of thing that if you touch, you may run the risk of losing your funding for what you're doing your research in. You know, so people don't want to be typecast as being UFO loonies or anything of the sort, so they stay away from it. But I think now it's safer ground to tread on, and partly the fact that Harvard is involved in it, and somebody, as we said earlier, with the stature of Dr. Loeb is leading it, then I think that helps to open that pathway wider, right? So, well, let's turn to the second of Galileo's specific goals that we talked about earlier, which is to research the origins of interstellar objects that exhibit unusual characteristics. And I'll say that the one that's gotten Avi Loeb and now Galileo a lot of attention is a mysterious object called, if I say this right, Oumuamua, which I think is a Hawaiian word meaning messenger from afar arriving first. Did I say that right?
That's right. Yep, that's correct.
Wow, I got lucky. So you're an Oumuamua fellow in the research program at the Galileo Project. So what's this object like? I mean, just tell us about it and what's unusual about it and so on.
Well, it had a few unusual characteristics. We only detected it as it was leaving the solar system, so we didn't have a lot of time to observe it. And we don't actually have a picture of it. All the pictures you see in the media are just artist renditions. They're not an actual picture of Oumuamua. We only managed to capture I think radio signals from it. But just to give you a bit of background on the properties of the Oumuamua. Obviously, one of the first thing is that everyone says that, well, a lot of people say that it was just a comet, right? But if it was a comet, it would have inherited the motion of its parent star. But instead, what we found was Oumuamua seems to have originated from the so-called local standard of rest, which is just a reference frame used in the local standard of rest, which is just a reference frame used in astrophysics to basically describe the motion of objects within the Milky Way galaxy, right? It's the location centered on the sun as it and it moves at constant velocity with respect to the average motion of the stars in the solar neighborhood. And by using this reference frame, astronomers can more easily compare the velocities of different objects and analyze their overall kinematics or motion within the Milky Way. So the initial velocity of Oumuamua as well was unusual for a natural object that originated from a nearby star. If it were a comet originating from the outskirts of some planetary system, it would have inherited the motion of its host star. But since fewer than 0.2 or so percent of all stars share Oumuamua's kinematic origin at the local standard of rest, it's unlikely that it originated from a near star system. And if it's artificial, then as Avi suggests in some of his papers, its initial conditions might have been, and this is some speculation, of course, but it's a possibility, that it might have been tailored, for example, to hide the identity of its host star system. The other thing is that it tumbled rather than rotated smoothly, and it did so every 8 hours. And as it did so, the brightness of the sunlight reflected from Oumuamua changed by a factor of 10, which means that it had an extreme shape. And at the 90% confidence level, the shape was like elongated disc-like shape. Then also there was the space telescope, and they didn't detect any carbon-based molecules or dust around Oumuamua. We didn't detect a significant amount of heat in the infrared, which placed an upper limit of about 200 meters on the size of the object, which is roughly the size of a football field. But probably the most interesting characteristic of Oumuamua is that it exhibited an excess push away from the sun, which would have required it to lose roughly around 10% of its mass if it was called by kind of the effect that you would observe from a normal cometary evaporation. As the comet is going towards the sun, you have the outgassing process where the elements heat up and are expelled from the object. So there's quite a few different characteristics of a moment which make it really interesting. But because we had such a very limited window in which we could observe it, well, not observe, I should say, but study it through radio, there's still a lot of uncertainty about its nature and its origin.
Well, we just have a minute or so left, but you know, I read recently that there's a theory that's kind of kiddingly called the farting space rock theory, that it's just basically off-gassing periodically, and that was giving it a thrust that would be abnormal and was allowing it to move away from the sun and move in unusual ways. But you know, without getting into that, I just thought I'd throw that in there because it was funny. But without getting into it much, I mean, just very briefly, what's the prevailing theory now among you guys, among Galileo researchers, about what it is? And more particularly, what do you think it is or was?
Yeah, well, I haven't actually heard of the farting.
Oh, really? The farting space rock.
Yeah, I haven't heard of it, actually.
I'll send you the link later. Okay, go ahead, though.
We don't, you know, as scientists, we try not to put any sort of label on what we think it is. We really want the data to speak to itself. And at this point, as I mentioned earlier, we just don't have enough information to put a proper label on it. But there are a number of theories out there. You know, some of them are from a porous structure with a mean density that's 100 times lower than air. Another one is a hydrogen iceberg or a nitrogen iceberg. But all these theories that have been put forward are things that we've never observed in space before. We never actually detected any of these things, so we can't say that, you know, this is that Oumuamua is this or that, because it just isn't really any data. So that's why we have this other segment of the Galileo project where we want to detect ISOs, more of them. We should be seeing a lot more of them, especially as the Vera Rubin telescope comes online, and hopefully from more observations we'll gather more data and we can start to characterize these things so that eventually one day we will be able to explain what Oumuamua was or is, I should say, because it's still out there. Mm-hmm. But until then, we just don't really know.
Okay, well, it's just one more mystery, but an interesting one. So I guess we have to leave it there, Richard, because we're about out of time, and we could talk a little bit more about some of the things that are going on and maybe speculate about the future of these researches. But I guess I'll tell our listeners to go, if you want to read more about Galileo Project, and there is a really nice website, go to projects.iq, like intelligence quotient, I guess, projects.iq.harvard.edu/Galileo, okay? projects.iq.harvard.edu/Galileo. And you'll see all the researchers there, including our guest, Dr. Cloutier, and you can read all about it. So thank you so much for being on with us. It's been very interesting.
Well, thank you. It was an honor. I hope everybody enjoys this episode.
I think they will. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.